Medication is the mainstay of treating symptoms in ADHD. However, there's more to treatment than that. In a recent issue of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report, we spoke to Dr. Edward Halliwell, founder of the Halliwell Centers in Boston, or as they pronounce it, Boston, New York City, San Francisco, and Seattle. Dr. Halliwell's approach to treating ADHD focuses on positivity and relationships. Mara and I are going to play some of the clips from that interview in this episode and highlight some practical tips that might benefit your practice. Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast. This is a special episode from the Child Psychiatry team. I'm Dr. Josh Fader, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report and co-author of the Child Medication Factbook for Psychiatric Practice.
Dr. Halliwell sure sounds wicked smart. And I'm Mara Governman, a licensed clinical social worker in Southern California with a private practice. And I'm also a regional director of Real Connections Child Institute.
Dr. Halliwell is extremely wicked smart. He is well known in the field. He's a writer and a speaker in addition to being a practicing psychiatrist. Dr. Halliwell was on the Harvard Medical School faculty for about 20 years. His first book, Driven to Distraction, came out in 1994, and he's written 19 more books since then. His podcast, Distraction, is great too. If you're interested in ADHD treatment, I highly recommend it.
He also wrote a book called The Childhood Roots of Adult Happiness. It's a five-step plan for parenting that focuses on positive and helpful attitudes rather than grades, sports, and achievements like that.
So we had a really good conversation with him, and it made for a great Q&A in the newsletter. But it's even better to hear him in person. And we're going to play some of those clips in this episode and talk about them.
He gave us a preview of his new book, which isn't even out yet, and it's an interesting take on ADHD. He's reimagining the disorder as VAST, V-A-S-T, which stands for Variable Attention Stimulus Trait.
Rebranding ADHD as VAST is part of his larger perspective on these kinds of disorders. Essentially, he's grappling with the conundrum we've all been grappling with. ADHD has commonly come to describe a huge variety of conditions and traits. These can ruin your life, or managed properly, they may be turned into assets.
This goes back to previous conversations we've had about ADHD overdiagnosis. Generally, there's a lot of confusion out there about it as a disorder. When you talk to patients, families, and educators, you often get a sense that maybe a case of ADHD is just kids acting out, and sometimes it gets chalked up to bad parenting.
A big part of this is the scope and variety of symptoms and indicators. Dr. Halliwell points out that what we call ADHD is common among people suffering from addiction and people who are unemployed. But it's also something found in some of the wealthiest and most successful people in our society. It's something you hear a lot about in entrepreneurs. But in those cases, people say they are restless and energetic, not hyper and easily distracted.
Turning perceived weaknesses into strength is an exciting treatment strategy. The question is, what does it mean for everyday practice? How do you actually turn an attention disorder into a strength when you're working with patients?
He had a really great analogy for this.
Having untreated ADD is analogous to Niagara Falls. It's just a lot of noise and mist until you build a hydroelectric plant. And when you build the hydroelectric plant, then you can light up the state of New York. And I'm in the hydroelectric plant business.
So hydroelectric plant to take the energy to turn it into something useful. You get that? It's a great analogy. I just love that idea because we see it all the time. When you find the right medication treatment for people suffering from these symptoms, they can suddenly think clearly. It's like they have their whole mind available to them. It's kind of like when you find the right activity for some people, they can turn it into a great strength. Like somebody who is very, very active and they've been told to sit down and not run around the class and stuff like that. But then you get them into a really great sport and they just surge forward among their peers, much easier to make friends and to relate to people and to connect to people. Not so much about the medication in that sense. It's more about channeling, you know, being in the right spot, in the right context.
as well as a naturalistic way to promote self-esteem and self-confidence.
Agreed.
So as a therapist, the first clinical step I'm taking is to set the stage for the patient. Dr. Hallowell has a great line of discussion for this.
You know, as so often happens, they just go off in seven directions at once and get nowhere. And that's so frustrating. And they know they could be doing better. My job is to say, yes, you're right. You could be. You're not lazy. You're not lacking in discipline. You're not characterologically flawed. You don't have a deficit disorder. What you have is an abundance of attention, not a deficit of attention, but you just have trouble channeling it. You have trouble focusing it.
A lot of these patients have self-esteem issues because maybe family and teachers have been hard on them leading up to the diagnosis. It takes away the idea that they are broken and that they need to be fixed.
The end result is that the patient and the clinician are on the same page that they are going to harness this abundance of attention to do something great. But what has worked for you in the past that we can intentionally use in moments when you notice that you're having a hard time paying attention or are easily distracted?
Yeah, how do we build on the times when who you are works really well for you?
How do you bring out the best version of yourself when you notice that you're having a hard time settling down and being calm to be able to access that?
Then the question becomes, how do you go about doing that? And clearly, going to medication is a big option. There are times when that doesn't work, though. And our bent is actually not to do meds first if we can avoid it. There's an example of an 8-year-old boy in Shanghai who Dr. Hallowell talks about.
In the book, I write about this little boy in Shanghai that I treated remotely. I was in Boston, he was in Shanghai, so 7,000 miles away, 8-year-old little boy, floridly ADHD, in trouble in school every day, bottom of his class, can't control his impulses, and they hit them with sticks over there, so he's getting hit with a stick every day. His mother, I went over to Shanghai to give a talk, and his mother begged me to treat him. And I said, well, I can't. I'm in Boston. She said, well, let's just tell me what to do. We'll do it via email. And we did. So the combination of education, persuading the teacher not to hit him with a stick anymore. So we eliminate fear, which is the real learning disability. So he's not afraid of getting hit every day. We get massive doses of love at home and explain to him that he has a race car brain with bicycle brakes. So he gets all excited about who he is instead of feeling ashamed of who he is. And he's really motivated to strengthen his brakes. And then we start doing these cerebellar exercises. And in 3 months, this little boy, it was totally reversed. He was at the top of the class. He was not acting out. He was loving school. And all the parents were coming to the mother and saying, what in the world did you do?
That's the ideal scenario. Break down the guidance he gave because it's pretty fascinating.
The first one is going to be pretty obvious to our listeners because most of us don't live in school systems with corporal punishment. Stop hitting the kid in school.
And stop hitting the kid at home.
Yeah, that too. Because fear is the real learning disability, right? In this case, it involved the mother talking to the teachers to get them to, you know, put down the ruler or whatever it was they were doing. The broader point about fear is important here, too. It involves having that same reorienting conversation you went over, Mara, about harnessing the abundance of attention. Having that same conversation with teachers, relatives, peers, and so on. Because imagine the fear patients are living under in class and socially. Just taking that aggravating fear away, or at least alleviating it, is a big first step.
So in general, we're going to get people in their lives to stop treating them like they are defective in some way and make them part of the team, helping them channel this as a strength.
So step two is also interesting. Dr. Hallowell suggested massive amounts of love to the mother. In a way that meant getting the mother to treat the abundance of attention as a positive quality waiting to be harnessed, and yet another reason why she loves her son so much. This is a beautiful idea for a lot of reasons, but it also has a functional element. It reorients the conversation between the patient and his mother. The patient is going to benefit from hearing it again from their loved ones, not just the clinician in an office visit. You know, I'll always tell patients how much I just really appreciate the things that they do, but they need to hear it outside. They need to hear from the people who really count, not just from me whenever they see me.
As well as you're talking about presuming competence and finding ways to help support that person to implement those strategies that you agree upon. All right. But all of that seems like something that's going to give some kind of treatment a better chance at success. It's not a treatment in itself.
Right. You have to do something to actually channel that abundance of attention. And like I said, this particular case was done without medication. He needed better breaks. And the way he got those was with a regimen of cerebellar exercises.
This was interesting to me. Basically, they involve balance. So skateboarding, skiing, surfing.
Yes, we're talking about any exercises that challenge balance and coordination, such as skiing, skateboarding, and surfing are helpful, as well as exercises that you can do at home, like practicing standing on one foot with your eyes closed or using a wobble board or some other balance toy.
In this anecdote, the patient goes from having a terrible time in school to top of his class in 3 months with less corporal punishment at school, more love at home, and balance exercises. Is this for real?
It's an amazing anecdote, but that's just it. It's just an anecdote. We don't have any controlled trials showing that cerebellar training techniques are effective. We do have studies showing physical exercise in general is effective as an adjunct treatment in ADHD. Dr. Hallowell agrees that more studies are needed, but he's aware non-medication studies aren't as likely to be funded as medication studies. However, he's pretty confident in his methods. He does have some good research to fall back on regarding the role of the cerebellum in brain function. Roy Rutherford in England and Jeremy Schmaman at Harvard Medical School did MRI studies showing that the cerebellum accounts for 75 to 80% of the brain's total number of neurons, even though it's only 10% of brain volume. There's a lot going on there, so if you strengthen the cerebellum, the idea is that you're very likely strengthening the entire functionality of the brain.
Apparently, there's a documentary coming out in 2021 that will portray more anecdotal success of his methods. So regardless of whether we get real studies on the cerebellar exercises, it's going to enter the conversation around these disorders, and we might have families asking about them as we discuss treatment plans.
It's already part of the conversation in other treatment areas. Dr. Elizabeth Torres from Rutgers has been focused on cerebellar function in autism and related disorders. What Dr. Hallowell is saying lines up with her work helping people to be more regulated and manage their sensory systems. Regardless, big disclaimer, nobody is claiming that this is a double-blind research-based treatment, and until it is, there are going to be reasonable question marks around it.
Exercise in general has good research behind it for ADHD, so it might as well be surfing and skateboarding, right? Especially for us here in Southern California. It always comes down to this, though, Josh. How does this affect our practice?
Dr. Hallowell has a very positive framework. Look for strengths, present the disorder as an abundance of attention, not a deficit. The treatment is a challenge or an opportunity to harness that attention. This sounds pretty familiar, actually. I think most of us in child and adolescent mental health have that general sense of the importance of positivity, even if we don't use that exact language.
Yeah, when we meet with families for an ADHD diagnosis, we don't throw our hands up and say, this is just terrible. We focus on the good news. We know what's going on, and there are lots of ways to make things better.
I really like the motto Dr. Hallowell shared with us in the interview.
When you come into one of my centers, it just feels like a happy place. You know, we have slogans on the wall, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. No brain is the same. No brain is the best. Each brain finds its own special way. It's just, it's bright and light, and it's all about connecting. It's all about positivity.
Another good tip he gave is to get lots of collateral information from other people so you can get other people's point of view, not just the point of view of the patient who might not feel so good about himself. And he recommends neuropsych testing if it's affordable for the patient. And that way you get a more solid picture of processing speed and memory and kind of figure out how you can find those ways to help each brain find its own special way. And of course, medication is still the most likely way to help kids deal with ADHD. When you've got a firm diagnosis, right? It's pretty reliable stuff. Dr. Hallowell presents this as an option with all the information about its effectiveness and even with the side effects.
It begins with education and diagnosis, and then we tailor a treatment plan depending upon the patient. We always offer medication. We offer it, you know, most people balk. They say, "Oh, I don't want medication." And I say, "Well, that's fine. You don't have to take it, but I'd at least like you to make the decision based on the facts and not on rumor and hearsay." And 9 out of 10 times when they learn the facts, they want to give it a try. And so we usually give a trial of medication. And then in conjunction with that, we do coaching. Most of these folks don't need psychotherapy. Sometimes they do, but usually it's coaching. It's lifestyle revision. It's tips on how to get organized, get dressed in the morning, you get your homework done. And then for adults, marry the right person, find the right job, learn how to, you know, go from A to B without taking too many detours. And that is best done in the context of a coaching relationship rather than a tell me how you feel about it relationship.
Dr. Hallowell talks about how, quote, we're living in an epidemic of disconnection, unquote.
We're living in an epidemic of disconnection. It's what drives depression, suicide, addiction, school shootings, you name it. It's about disconnection. And so if only people could realize that.
This is something that we've heard a lot in public discourse. People are feeling isolated. His positive observation is a great point to keep in mind as we go about our work.
The key to a great childhood and the key to a great life is connection, is love, is having positive points of connection to friends, to family, to a dog. I prescribe dogs to activities, to job, to work, to nature, to places, to festivities, all that. Positive connection, and we need it so much these days. I mean, we know from research that social isolation is as bad for you as cigarette smoking. And the beauty of connection is that it's free. And it's infinite in supply. People just don't take it seriously enough, or they don't know how to get it because they're shy, or there are ways to get it. Even if you're shy, there are ways to get it. Even if you feel, you know, depressed, and that's where people need help from folks like you and me, or teachers or coaches or parents, you know.
That's a great way to look at our jobs, isn't it?
It sure is.
The full interview is available for subscribers to read in the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report. Hopefully people will check it out. Subscribers get print issues in the mail and email notifications when new issues are available on the website. Subscriptions also come with full access to all the articles on the website and CME credits.
Tell them about the discount.
Since you've listened this far, you can get a full subscription of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report for $30 off using the coupon code LISTENER.
Talk to you later.